It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you the teachings not only of my teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on his teachings, passing on the meaning of the teachings of all the great ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today's talk is about the way to study Zen. Most people start to study Zen in order to know what Zen is, Roshi says, but this is already wrong. They are always trying to provide some understanding or some rules for themselves. But here is what Roshi says to a group of students at Tassajara who have been there for the summer practice period, which is ending with a 7-day sesshin. It's very hot. The Zendo is fly-ridden. And listen carefully to what he tells us to do instead. The way to study Zen should be like the way a fish picks up its food. It does not try to catch anything. It just swims around. And if something good comes up, snap. Even though it's very hot and you're observing Tassajara rules, eating in the hot Zendo like a fish swimming around, and if something good comes, snap. As you are doing so, you will get something. I don't know whether you, this is Roshi talking now, I don't know whether you realize it or not, but as long as you are following the rules, you will have something. Even though you don't have anything or study anything, you are actually studying like a fish who doesn't seem to know what it's eating. That's all. We should study Zen in that way. To understand does not mean to understand something through your head. So let's just pause right here. What's the difference between what most people do and what Roshi is saying to do? Most people, Roshi says, come to Zen to find out what Zen is. They are curious. They come as an observer to figure out this thing over there with a cool name, but Zen is nothing. They're never going to find out what Zen is using their observing minds. Instead, Roshi says, be like a fish picking up its food. It doesn't try to catch anything. It just swims around. And if something good comes, snap. And snap means alert and ready. Snap means alert and ready. Swimming around means your everyday life. So alert and ready in your everyday life, like a fish who swims around, snap. Roshi uses that same image with frogs also. You might remember, I know I've told you about frogs. Because our innate nature seems to already know what we should be doing, questioning why just leads to confusion. Why are we doing this? Dogen said, the bird does not need to know the limit of the sky before it flies in it. Birds just fly in the big sky. That's how we practice Zazen. So today's verse is very easy, actually. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? So that's Akito. That's Akito's verse for today. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. The key word is meaning. Regarding this line, Roshi, it tells us that in Sakito's time, each master had his own approach to teaching the Buddha's way. And because the students kind of stuck with their own teacher, Zen became broken up into all these different schools. And so it was hard for people to know, well, which one is the real way? And so actually, it won't surprise you, Roshi says, you know, that's already wrong, wondering which is the real way. Because it objectifies your experience and separates you from your experience. So which is the real way, you know, over there? Is this, you know, it's all in your head. So each teacher was suggesting the way of the Buddha. They're all coming from the same source. So Sakito is saying, don't stick to words, don't stick to rules. Understand the source of the teaching transmitted from the Buddha beyond each teacher's way of expressing it. One might translate, if you're a fish, don't waste time asking, you know, am I in the right pond? Just swim around. And if something good comes, snap. So you're there inside your experience, snapping at the right time. Then the next line, don't set up standards of your own. Roshi says, this line may not seem to mean much, but in Sakito's time, Sakito felt like that, don't set up standards of your own. It's like you're, don't try to understand through your head. That's what he was saying that it means. And Roshi says, don't try to understand with your head. You should do things like a mule or an ass. In other words, just follow along. No need to question too much. Just follow along. Don't be too smart. And also, when you enter a monastery, you shouldn't say, I have my own way. If you come to Tassajara, for example, you just obey Tassajara rules. You do not establish your own rules. Roshi says to see the actual moon through Tassajara rules is the way to practice a Tassajara. So I know you're probably thinking, well, I thought we're not supposed to focus on rules, but Roshi never sticks to just one side. So the other side is, if you're at Tassajara, you follow Tassajara rules because it's not the rules that are important, but it's the teachings that the rules will catch. The rules catch teachings, and by following them, you understand what teachings the rules have caught. And so by observing the rules, you'll naturally understand the teachings. And Roshi thinks that from the beginning, this point is missed by many of us, that the rules catch the real understanding. So it's not the rules, it's how we follow. It's not the rules, it's how we metabolize the rules, how we follow them, how we use them for our understanding. I'm free associating a little bit, but Prince Charles, who's next in line to be England's king, at one point he was so interested in Eastern religions that he went to India to live in an ashram. And he took his chef and his own food. Undoubtedly, he thought that since he was Prince Charles, everyone would excuse him. But he missed this critical point. By observing rules, you will naturally understand the real teaching. He missed that point. He needed to be on vacation from Prince Charles and be just like a mule or an ass instead. Or he could have just melted into the woodwork and been silent while he was there. But bringing his food and his chef was actually creating his own obstacle to the very understanding that he came there to get. Observers really can't get the heart-mind essence that's easily available to participants. And then the last lines, if you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Here Roshi says, the only way is to use your five sense organs wherever you go, simultaneously to understanding the source of the teaching. If you don't do this, even though you move your feet or you practice, you cannot know the true way. So we use our bodies, we use all of our senses, and we think about the source of the teachings. To summarize, the most important thing is not finding the rules, but finding the source of the teaching, using your senses wherever you are. This is the direct way. Each moment, you intuitively know what to do. If you stick to words, you do not see the true way through your own eyes and ears and nose and tongue. Roshi is really strong about this. He says, if you stick to rules and ignore the direct experience of your everyday life, even though you practice Zazen, it won't work. If you stick to rules and ignore the direct experience of your everyday life, even though you practice Zazen, it doesn't work. Because in everyday life, there's a Tao, a way. And if you do not practice in the midst of your everyday activity, there's no approach to the true way. This is what Sakito means. So don't stick to words. Don't make rules or force rules on others. He says, Roshi says, it's not possible to force rules on others anyway, because each person has his own way and should have his own way. Last week, we were talking about suffering styles, and someone asked about my style of suffering, and I answered generically, like things that comfort me, like reading and keeping warm. But later I realized I have a very personal way that actually helps me very much. And I do it so often, I forgot why I invented it in the first place. So in the moment that I was asked what was my suffering style, I forgot that it was a suffering style. So I'm going to tell you now, starting from a place of chronic pain from scoliosis. So here's what I thought. So I'm always in chronic pain. So why not use this pain I have anyway, no matter what, to help other people who have pain? So I made up a prayer, and I like to make up my own prayers. And the prayer is, here's the prayer. May all the pain of all suffering beings ripen on the pain in this body right now. May all the pain of all suffering beings ripen on the pain in this body right now. Ripen means to just give over all of it. Just give over all of it. That way, I figure, everyone can throw their suffering onto mine, but it's a win-win because, first of all, I get helped by the feeling of helping other people. And that's a style, by the way. So that's a style. That's a suffering style. While it may not work for everyone, the principle behind it can, because the how of how I came up with it, will work for everyone, which is consult your pain. What is my suffering? Consult your pain. What is my suffering and your nature? For me, poet, and from the partnership will arise a way that is your own. And since it fits you perfectly, you'll do it a lot and you'll feel better a lot. But it's not a rule. It's just following your nose or being like a fish. The five most important points from today's talk are, first, the way to study Zen should be like the way a fish picks up its food. It does not try to catch anything. It just swims around. And if something good comes, snap. Secondly, rules are not the point. The teaching that the rules will catch is the point. By observing rules, you will naturally understand the real teaching. Thirdly, you should do things like a mule or an ass. That means just go along. Don't get in your head too much. Things meaning Zen-related things. But maybe your everyday life too. Fourthly, Dogen Zenji says, the bird does not need to know the limit of the sky or what the sky is before flying in it. Birds just fly in the big sky. That's how we practice Zazen. And lastly, fifthly, if you stick to words, if you do not see the true way through your own eyes, ears, nose, and tongue, if you stick to rules and ignore the direct experience of everyday life, even though you practice Zazen, it doesn't work. So here are five things to do or think about during the week. First, I have found that the first fruits of people's self-study, you know, Dogen says Zen is the study of the self. And the first way that shows, or often I've seen this a lot, is some form of people getting more precisely in touch with their daily routine. So even something as seemingly simple as getting out of bed or getting ready for your day before you leave your room, make a list of all the things that you need to complete that one thing. So I'm just using your getting up routine as an example, but all the things you need to do before you go on to the next phase of your day, make a list of them, try to write them down and see if you can make really conscious what you're doing. When you routinize something, what are you doing? And this is a lesson in awareness. And secondly, picking up from the first idea of awareness you can use your breath to recover yourself and be yourself. Thich Nhat Hanh makes a suggestion of before eating a meal, you can practice breathing by taking 3 slow breaths. Children, he says, can go into a room after breakfast and sit down and breathe 10 times. In, out, 1. In, out, 2. Before they go to school. Or if 10 is too much, 3 times. This is a way to start the day being a Buddha. Thirdly, and another Thich Nhat Hanh awareness practice is walking. Walking meditation is really to enjoy the walking. It's not in order to arrive, but just for walking. So we say, Zazen is doing Zazen. It's just for Zazen. And walking is just for walking. The purpose is to be in the present moment and enjoy each step. Fourthly, this idea of even though you don't have anything or study anything, you are actually studying like a fish who doesn't know what he's eating. That's all. We should study Zen in that way. And I want to suggest that the next time you have that kind of fish swimming around mind, notice it. What is it? What is that mind? I've suggested things like this before, but it's a really important mind. And I just encourage you to notice it in yourself and pay attention. And lastly, Roshi says that moment after moment, we should follow the flow of time. We should go with time, meaning you should not do things just to kill time. Yet we all have ways to kill time. What are yours? That's the fifth thing. What are your ways to kill time? I wonder if there are any questions.
Thank you, Gail. The first question that we have is, the line, don't make up rules of your own, does that hold for lay people as well? I know in a monastery, you should just follow what has been established. But when we want to start our own home practice, don't we need to make our own rules?
Of course, only you know the inside of your situation and what your household can handle. So yes, you do need to make up rules around a home Zen practice. But that said, let me give you a wonderful example. It's a pretty high bar, but John Dido Lurie, who he's passed away, the Roshi of Zen Mountain Monastery, he was a layman for a very long time. And he was a photographer, and he lived with his wife and child in a rural area where, he and his wife were very serious Zen students, and he had recorded all of the sounds in a monastery once, right from the very beginning, the wake up bells, you know, all of the sound, morning sounds, including the bells for before and after Zazen. And he had this recording. And so he and his wife made a zendo in their home where they both sat. And they played this recording of all the sounds. And then after they finished Zazen, they had breakfast silently. And then they went about their days. And he, I think he, several times a week, he went to sit with other people so that it wasn't all just alone. And he also had a teacher with whom he had doksan. So he had private interviews with his teacher. I'm not sure about his wife in this case, but that's a really good model of using the sound system of an established Zen center to get yourselves through a morning practice and then eating in silence and then starting your day and maybe having a second period of Zazen in the evening. So I'm just throwing that out as a terrific model, actually. No wonder he ended up a Roshi. But we don't have to aspire to all of it. But yes, you do need to make your own rules because only you know what your household can absorb. That's all.
Gil, the next question that we have is, can you give some examples of the rules at Dasahara, the ones that catch the teaching of Zen?
I'm glad you asked, and I will give you, but I realized I forgot to say something in this little thing I just said about your home practice. No matter what you do, it should be set. It shouldn't be according to your convenience. So whatever you make up, and we'll talk about that in a second, it's set in stone until at a later time when a neutral state of mind, you think it over carefully and you decide, I think I'm going to change this to that for whatever reason. And then you follow, and then that's set and you follow that. That's so that it becomes a practice. If you just, you know, you say you're going to sit for half an hour and then after 20 minutes, you're tired and you go, well, I think I'll just do 20 minutes after all. That's not practice. So whatever you say, whatever you established, that will be your practice and you do it. You do your practice. Otherwise, it's not practice and it won't help you in the same way. It's not, for one, it's not as a purifying it. An activity, but there are other reasons too. So you're asking, what are some of the rules for a home practice? And I think if I were setting up a home practice in a household with children, I would do everything before they got up. So you'd have to get up very early. And the ticket to that is go to bed very early. So you might put your child to bed depending on its age and then maybe have a very short period of Zazen before bed and go to bed very early. So you'd get 8 hours sleep before getting up very early for this morning session. And then the morning session could be also set, you know, what you do, have all the things you need for what you do. And then that's what you do. And you know what you do. It's totally possible. And everything is in place. And so that those would be kind of like rules. I think it's really good to frame your day. I think it's good to have a morning period and maybe a shorter, but still something in the evening to sort of frame your day with zazen, so that your day feels like it's organized around Zen practice? The only other thing that comes to mind is some kind of, I'm going to use a non-Zen word, but in Christian traditions, there's something called Lectio Divina, which is like divine reading. And it's very helpful to read, in this case, Buddhist writers. It's very helpful, even if you just read a paragraph. The add-on I would say to what I just said would be a period of reading Buddhist writing. That's all that comes to mind right now.
Thank you, Gail. So the question was that if you could give some examples of the rules from Tassajara, the ones, yeah, that catch the teaching of Zen.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
If you want to add to it, yeah.
You know, the rules at Tassajara, they aren't exactly rules. They're a schedule. And on the schedule, just about every 5 minutes of your day is covered. So there's almost no free time. And, you know, the bell rings and you get up, and then another bell rings and you, by which you need to be in the zendo. It's not a bell, actually, it's a han, a wooden mallet. And then there are all kinds of bells in the zendo telling you what to do. And then there's a kind of service, including bowing afterwards. Then there's study period, and there's a work period. And all of the meals are in the zendo, so you're eating with, even your eating is very formal with these bowls, and there's a whole procedure about how to use the bowls. So there's almost nothing you do that's not a group activity, even though your part might be assigned to you're assigned to the kitchen, someone else is assigned to the garden, but it's still during work period, you're doing your assigned work. It's very regimented, put it that way. It's extremely regimented. And the schedule is what catches the teachings. Following the schedule day in and day out, no matter what you're feeling, and pretty soon you realize it doesn't even matter what you're feeling. You just do it anyway. There's that mule or ass aspect to it. You know, you just simply show up in the zendo when the bell rings or the han rings. It's that continuous one thing after another feeling. The day rolls by in its organized, appropriate way, and you follow it day after day. Those are the rules that catch the teaching. Within that, you study yourself, and it's the study of the self that Dogen says is Zen practice. I hope that answered your question.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, I love the fish swimming around method of learning. The book says the rule at Tassajara is, it is not always so. Is that meant to summarize the Tassajara rules, or is that one of many?
That has nothing to do with Tassajara. I mean, it has everything to do with Tassajara. Just as I had two sentences today that totally contradicted each other. One is don't pay any attention to rules. And the other is follow the rules because they catch the meaning. Not always so is Suzuki Roshi's slogan about life. Nothing is always so. So he's famous for saying one thing and then 2 seconds later saying just the opposite. Because it's not always so. So it really not always so, which is the title to one of his books, which are, again, lectures that have been transcribed. He didn't really write books, but he did give lectures that were transcribed. And one of them is transcribed in a book called Not Always So, because that is so inherent to the way Roshi operates. Nothing is always so. That's all.
The next question is, can you say more about the Prince Charles story? What if he needed a special diet for his health?
You know, visiting an ashram, it's not like visiting a museum. When he went, except I want to say, if the practice is inspirational to you, then you can just go there and be inspired to do your own practice. But bringing your own food and chef to prepare it gives the meta message is their food and their kitchen is not good enough for you. And if he needed to eat special food, he could have told the head cook in advance about his dietary needs, and the kitchen could have arranged to prepare that for him. And especially they could have gotten the special things that he needs for his diet, and then entrusting their kitchen to take care of him as their guest would have shown a lot of respect. So he could have had all his needs met, being very respectful. But he would have still been set apart, but not nearly as much. And to show that he could entrust himself to them, I think would have given just the opposite message. And just while I'm talking about this, you might think, well, he was Prince Charles. So of course everybody would have sort of, been treating him specially. But I remember one of the practice periods when I was at Tassajara, Governor Brown and his then girlfriend, Linda Ronstadt, I'm not sure I know her last name. They came during a practice period, which is forbidden. No one comes during a practice period. But I think Governor Brown was a friend of Baker Roshi's. And so anyway, so they came and everyone realized they just wanted to be left alone. So everyone left them alone. No one paid them any mind. So Prince Charles could have been left alone. He could have come silently done the practice, thank you very much, and then left. He didn't need to do it that way. At least that's my opinion. He might say something very different. That's all.
The next question is, if you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Sometimes I don't understand the way right before me. Then what should I do?
Nothing. Stop. Just stop altogether. Stop. Just stop. And wait. Wait until something comes to you. Something that you like to do, something that you know is right for you. And then just look at it. Look at, what is this? How do I know it's right for me? And how do I know is a big one. How do I know? Where is that place of knowledge inside me? How do I know me? And then you get in touch with where is the seat of that knowledge? And then you go there when you have questions. Well, let me ask my stomach, you know, what does it think is the next thing I should do? And then you just wait. You wait. Just wait till your stomach tells you. And it will. It actually will. Sometimes when people don't know the way right before them, they're not being still or silent enough. That said, guilt and shame have very boisterous vibrations, and they'll get in the way too of you hearing yourself. That's all.
The next one is, in everyday life, there is Tao. The way, and if you do not practice in the midst of everyday activities, there is no approach to the true way. My life is very chaotic, working from home with two young children and unreliable help. Can I really approach a true way in the midst of what feels tumultuous? I don't know how to steady myself even for a morning.
The Tao of your life does sound tumultuous, but life itself is tumultuous. We don't know. We're not in control. We don't know what's going to happen. We rarely know what we're doing. Everything is impermanent. And we suffer from that along with all of our afflictions, greed, hate, and delusion. So start right here. Think of it as a gift. Think of your tumultuous life as a gift from the universe to teach you how to live within tumultuous circumstances, which actually all of our lives, maybe not this one day, but it'll be the next day for sure. You know, we don't go very many days without tumultuous circumstances. So the idea of, well, as soon as it gets calm, then I'll whatever, as soon as then never works. That kind of thinking, it simply doesn't work ever for anything. As soon as you da-da, then I'll da-da-da. You should, whatever it is, you should do it now, no matter what the circumstances. It's not as soon as then. I work with writers a lot, and they go, well, as soon as my life, da-da-da, then I'll start writing. And you know, I already know they're never going to be writing, because you have to find a way to do it now within all of the chaos. And so rather than push it out, be very grateful. Just be grateful. Thank you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. Thank you. I'm going to figure it out right now. That's a better way. That's all.
Next one is, I am just starting to get the flavor of just swimming around. And if something good comes along, snap. Could you talk about this a little more?
First of all, it's very non-aggressive. It's non-aggressive. And it's also fundamentally practicing gratitude and receiving your life instead of getting or going after something. It's a stance of receiving. So I'm just swimming around, and if something good comes, I'll receive it. I'm not, it's non-aggressive. And so it helps you also to tune into your life and optimize your situation. It's very respectful of yourself and your circumstances and the routines you've put into place. It allows you to study yourself. Actually, taking a receiving stance rather than a getting stance is, it readjusts our perspective to be more in line with reality. That's all.
Keel, the next question is, can one kill time by following the flow of time?
If you're present, you won't kill time. Killing time is being spaced out or absent-minded or under the influence of whatever, so that you're not fully conscious, alert, and ready like fish are. Fish don't kill time. They're always swimming around alert and ready. So the way to kill time is losing your consciousness and your sense of being present in your life right now. So if you're following the flow of time and you start thinking about, you know, what you're going to cook for dinner, yeah, you're killing time.
Thank you, Keel. That was the last question.
You know, someone asked me to tell more stories. And I actually brought, I realized that I have written 4 stories about the lives of the 4 great haiku masters. And haiku, being master of anything, you kind of already understand the Zen way, but haiku masters in particular were doing Zen practice. And so hearing about their lives is really helpful, I think. And so I wrote from the standpoint of the haiku master, for all 4 of them, I wrote 4 different stories, life stories, in the form of haibun, which is a piece of prose and then a haiku. So I'm using I, and so I'm writing as if I'm that haiku master. And I was looking them over, and most of them are really too long for like a 10-minute period that we have. But one of them might be doable if you think that's a good thing to do. The one on Isa. So Basho was one, and Shiki was one, and Busan was one, and Isa was one. Those are the four all-time great haiku masters. You know, maybe I'll start. There are like 15 little sections to this. Maybe I'll start, and if we run out of time, I could finish next week. Does that sound like a good idea? I hope so. So this poem is called Isa Isa. O Isa, carver of poems, even in soba flower. Listen, a mother crow caws pitiably for her injured young. As for me, I sometimes wander, which is worse, feeling the feelings of the distraught crow or feeling the lack of them. Scattered seeds on hunter's soil, a crane. The second verse, when I hear the story of the stepmother who agrees to feed her near famished stepchild only if the village statue eats the rice she cruelly makes him offer it. Of course, the stone statue wolfs it down. I can't resist. Serves the old woman right. Now she must feed her own children, her stepchild, and the stone statue. And the haiku, Basho, your rainproof paper hat, the one you made imitating saigyos. I too have felt desperately alone. Three. Though Senroku and I have different mothers, that in itself would not account for the hostility between us. Surely we were enemies in a previous life. Satsu also, vicious and contentious as she mostly is, cannot be without motives carried over from a former debt. Fog rolls in. Fat gulls hover over the water. Four. Father's words arising from his delirium. Don't fall in the well. Don't fall in the well. I would die to be again the child he has in mind. New Year's Eve, listen, snow is falling. Five. When Satsu hears, don't fall in the well, she screams, beet red, pointing a finger at the dying man, your precious son, so you love him as much as this? Scattering rice, pigeons and sparrows, shoo away the clucking chicks. Six. While you are in Zenkoji, would you please bring me some sugar? Father requests towards dawn. Sugar forces down the phlegm that interferes with his breathing. Satsu. It's just wasted on someone about to die. She rattles on, really being bothered by the fact that father shares his sugar with me. Full moon, facing it, knees braced beneath my robe. Seven. children from my village observe a peculiar custom. Capturing a lively frog, they bury it, cover its grave with plantain grass, and run away. Hey ho, the frog is dead. Hey ho, the frog is dead. Come, let us bury him. Come, let us bury him under plantain leaves. Under plantain leaves. Bowing over the frog's grave, cherry blossoms. 8. Having planted a chestnut in a sunny corner of my garden, I am thrilled to see it sprout, but soon a new addition on my neighbor's house blocks it from light and rain. Thereafter, my seedling manages to grow little more than a foot. When winter comes, my neighbor shovels snow off his rooftop onto the ground, breaking the sapling at its base. Indeed, such is the fate of this poor tree that every winter, snow from the roof stunts it again. Draped over a stone. Are you dead yet, little goldfish? 9. Having walked a good way beyond the village of Chuikuchi, I can't pronounce it, to visit Shorai, my beloved friend, I learn he has been dead these 15 years. His successor, a priest, denies me even so much as a place to rest. Wet spring night, wandering aimlessly, Chorai close by. 10. As for my unpaid debt to father, a drifter is hardly filial. My wanderings, my staying away till my hair is white, no wonder I consider whether the 5 violations can be worse than this. Even in his company, seeing his gray hair, I long for his company. 11. My inability to sever the ties of affection for my daughter, Sato, reflects a profound misunderstanding of the nature of impermanence. For this reason, I am deeply embarrassed. Yet I hear of enlightened masters pleading with their teachers, don't die, please don't leave us. Midsummer night, the feverish man frets over his little boy of years ago. 12. I quickly forgive Takamaru's parents for weeping shamelessly, even though they are priests who preach indifference to life's vicissitudes. Who can blame them, I assure myself. It is only human that their heart should be deeply oppressed by their unbreakable attachment to the child. Wedged in the pocket of the drowned boy, blossoms a butterbur. 13. As for the hollow New Year's observances, you'll find no crane, no tortoise, no pine beside my door. Why should I sweep out the dust when my tiny cottage might at any moment be whisked away by the wild north wind? Silent house, silent snow, I stand in the moonlit doorway. 14. My Kiku, she never cares how she looks. I inscribe, imagining I am capturing something of my wife with her baggy mompe, cotton kerchief, and scarlet braids. Now I see that I, who think nothing of visiting the Lord of Kaga in my scraggly clothes, am merely recognizing and admiring something of myself in this lackadaisical side to her. Morning glories, stumbling upon them outside my gate. 15. No matter how many villagers pick fruit from the old chestnut tree near Suha's shrine, it never lacks, at the very fewest, one or two of its little prickly husks for the next hungry person. Dusk, cakes rising on the stove, the moon, and finally, until he learns its meaning, Ota, the wealthy baron, is naturally irritated at receiving from the farmer's daughter, instead of the cape he requests in the sudden rainstorm, a sprig of caria. He is deeply embarrassed, however, to learn from a retainer that her gesture, being a punning allusion to an old poem, is a poetical way of expressing that no cape is available. Ashamed of his ignorance, he becomes an eager student of literature. Dawn, softly, softly through the undergrowth. So that's all. I think we've gone over a little bit, but I hope it was worth it. Bye-bye.